All right, everyone, while other people continue to trickle in here, I'll go ahead and get started. Hi, everybody. I'm Julie Matthews. Great to have you join us today for this webinar. We're going to be talking about choosing a diet strategy for gut health and healing. And so I'm really excited to have you here with us today. We are here with all NTA people. So this is going to be exclusively for you in preparation for the upcoming NTA conference. For those that can make it and can't make it, I wanted to do a pre-webinar, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. In fact, for the NTA conference, I will be doing a pre-conference workshop that very first day, which is that Thursday? Thursday, March 2nd, I will be doing a full day pre-conference workshop on bio-individual nutrition, and we will be talking about gut health in that as well. So if you can join us for that, and then we'll be going through a lot of new, hopefully new and interesting content for you and those interested in specialized diets. And so I'm looking forward to sharing that along with more information on our institute with you. So I'm going to just get a sense from people if they are a current practitioner or an NTA student. So if you can, I'm going to launch this little poll here. And if people have a chance to let us know, that'll give me a sense of kind of who we have on the call today. There's about 40% of people that are students and 60% of people who are practicing. It gives me a nice sense. Well, it's great to have all of you on the call today. Welcome to all of you who are joining us for this topic. Let's go ahead and go over to my PowerPoint. So to kind of get us off to a good start for the NTA conference and to share some information with you that I think will really be right in line with this, what I think is a really important topic, because I think it's really great that NTA chose this topic for this year, because as most of us know, the gut is so crucial for good health, and food has so much to do with it, because food is hitting the gut every time we eat something, and so choosing the right diet is absolutely critical. So I'm Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant. I am the founder and creator of the Bio-Individual Nutrition Institute and our training program, as well as Nourishing Hope. And today I wanted to share more with you about a topic that I've been studying for about 15 years, which is how to bio-individualize a diet for the individual person and what their underlying needs are. All right, here. So I'm going to start with a little bit on GI health and the microbiome. The gut, the reason that the gut is so important is because kind of everything starts from there. You need to have all of your biochemistry working, you need to bring in nutrients from the outside, which means they need to come in from your diet. And then your gut needs to be able to digest those foods and absorb those nutrients in order to have all the building blocks we need for all the biochemical processes that we create in our body, as well as using those nutrients directly for all sorts of functions. So it's not surprising at all that, as Hippocrates said many, many years ago, all disease begins in the gut. And looking at the immune system and how powerful it is, it's going to be the physical barrier and our first line of defense against pathogens. Our largest part of the immune system is found in the gut, and all sorts of other really important functions. And as I said, because we eat food all the time and it's going through our gastrointestinal system, the foods that we choose are really crucial. So the gut is really essential for really all health and disease. So it's going to be essential for making sure that we stay healthy, and it's also going to, and reversing disease, as well as if the gut is not healthy, it is going to likely be a factor or co-contributing, play a co-contributing role. And so, you know, whether you specialize in gut health, I think last time we did a webinar, we had about, I think, 40% of the people on the line who actually specialized in gut health. And so, you know, obviously this topic will be very interesting to you if you work specifically with gastrointestinal disorders, but also because all disease really stems from a poor gut function. really anything that we work with, all disease, again, everything from thyroid issues to autoimmune conditions to neurological challenges, anxiety, depression, autism, Hashimoto's, you know, pick the condition, and likely it is going to either originate in the gut or the gut is going to play an important role in the healing process. So understanding the role of food and diets is going to be crucial to your success in helping your clients. And so we're going to look at both foods that irritate as well as it's important to look at foods that heal the gut. I think that a lot of times programs do a pretty good job of looking at the foods that heal the gut. You know, we always hear about fermented foods and probiotics and looking at bone broths and, you know, all of this kind of good anti-inflammatory foods and herbs and spices and things. But we often don't talk too much about foods that irritate the gut. It's particularly things outside of gluten or grains. I feel like once we get beyond that, that's usually an area I don't really hear much about. So that's what I really want to share with you today. And the systems all work together. So if the immune system's not working well and we have gut inflammation, that is going to affect our digestive capacity. If we have pathogens that we can't fight off because we have poor immune function, those are going to affect our digestion and any additional challenges that happen to the functioning of our digestive system, or overload our detoxification system from the toxins that are released by them. So all of this is going to be very important in looking at how all of this comes together and how all of this is going to have an effect including downstream of what happens in the brain if we're talking about anxiety or depression or schizophrenia or bipolar or autism or any of those types of conditions. Those are going to be factors as well. But any, you know, we can look at all sorts of other conditions that are related to cellular function or other conditions as well and see how that is going to have an effect and how all these systems play together. So good bacteria, we probably, most of us know, is going to be very important for our health. In fact, if we didn't have microbes, we would likely not be alive because they do so many crucial things for us. And in fact, they're a defense system against the bad guys. So I could probably say with fairly good certainty if your microbiome is incredibly disrupted, it would have a major impact on your health, if not your life, really. And so the good bacteria is going to regulate bowel movements and peristalsis so that we have the ability to digest those foods in a proper manner. Looking at the breakdown of toxins, making vitamins that we need, producing antibacterial and antifungal type compounds, supporting the immune system, balancing intestinal pH, keeping that internal environment of the gut in good shape to do what it needs to do, and actually can protect us against environmental toxins as well, and breakdown of used hormones and all sorts of other things. So this good bacteria, we need a good bacterial balance, and we need good food coming in that can support it, and also food that is not going to further disrupt that bacterial balance. So to support the gut, there's some basic things, you know, avoiding all allergenic or sensitivity type foods, avoiding inflammatory foods, whether that's outside of the allergenic foods, whether it's gluten or and you know, other types of things, whether it's eggs. We're going to talk a lot about of other types of inflammatory foods like oxalates and other things that are not talked about too often today. We're going to, it's really important to avoid sugar, as sugar is going to feed those pathogens. Sugar is very inflammatory. Reducing or avoiding grains, depending on the person and what other things that they have going on. Increasing probiotics and fermented foods. Considering the use of digestive enzymes, choosing the right therapeutic diet for the right individual is what I think what we're going to spend most of our time today on, which is choosing that right diet or combination of diets for the bio-individual needs of that individual person. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Just in terms of what a healthy diet looks like, you know, it's important that whatever special diet that you choose, that it's healthy, that it's varied enough in foods, that there are enough different nutrients that somebody needs in order to, you know, have it be nutrient sufficient, as well as, you know, not containing the things that we said, like we said, that are problematic. So this is my food pyramid. We won't really go too much into it today, but if you, you know, I just wanted to basically call out that the diet needs to also be dense in nutrients. And that might be obvious to all of us as nutrition practitioners and students and professionals, but it's really important because a lot of special diets are more restrictive. And when they're more restrictive, you restrict nutritional value. And so that's where it's important to get a balance of those two things. But let's go into a little bit of what I would kind of use when I work with my with the people that are in my program, in terms of what a framework is for determining the bio-individual nutrition approach for each person. So I want to share with you some of the tools that I use to train other practitioners and teach at some of the conferences that I speak at. So what I've come up with over, so let me give you just a tiny little bit of background here, in that I have been working with complex neurological conditions for about the past 15 years. That includes, you know, everything from autism to a variety of other neurological challenges associated with, you know, sensory processing disorder and ADHD and anxiety, depression, those sorts of things, with a particular focus of mine in autism. However, as we'll see here, chronic disease is really chronic disease, and that inflammation is something that we want to address no matter what the condition that we're looking at is. But what I did when I was working with the individuals was try to figure out when a particular diet worked well and when a diet didn't work well. And personally, what I did was I really dove into the underlying biochemistry. You don't need to do that. I'm going to try to simplify that for you. If you're interested in it, you know, there's lots of information I can give you that you can sort of, you know, dive into that if it's fun for you. But what I'm going to do is try to distill all of that research and all of that clinical experience down into what I think are six simplified steps to help somebody figure out how to bio-individualize a nutrition plan for somebody in their practice. So today we're going to jump straight to pillar number five. But just to give you a quick sense, you know, when I look at this, I'm looking at the first thing is understanding chronic disease in general. So whether you're working with, like we said, an autoimmune condition or a digestive disorder or an immune system issue or a neurological issue or whatever it happens to be, understanding what those core underlying biochemical factors are and other health and you know, genetic and other types of things are. And then determining the bioindividuality of the person so that you're able to apply the right approach. Then I look at how foods affect biochemistry and how our biochemistry affects the foods that we can tolerate so that we can figure out what problems may arise for people, what they might be reacting to when they come to see you. And then looking at mastering special diets and looking at all the different special diets, I look at about 12 at a minimum when I'm assessing what diet or combination of diet strategies might be helpful for somebody. And then step five is really customizing the bio-individual nutrition strategy to the person. And today we're going to talk about some of those pieces and some of those steps and then evolving the diet from there, because we don't want to, you know, people change, people heal, people have new assaults to their system sometimes, unfortunately, and we might need to evolve the diet approach. We will want to evolve the diet approach as you go on. Let me start. Actually, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do two steps. Sorry, today I'm going to do two things. I'm going to start with determining the bioindividuality and talk about that, and then I'm going to go more into that step number five on the strategy plan. So in terms of determining bioindividuality, there are all these different factors that I think underlie chronic disease. Inflammation. Inflammation is a factor in, let's see if I have some of my conditions. Here we go. Inflammation is a factor in every one of these disorders that I have listed here. And this is just a small subset of them. Inflammation really, to me, underlies all disease, really, because inflammation, oxidative stress are often generated when the system's not functioning well. And when they are generated, then the system functions more poorly. So kind of you get it from both directions there. I won't go into all of these, but today we're going to touch specifically on inflammation, a mitochondrial dysfunction, poor sulfation, and a microbiome imbalance. So those are the four I wanted to touch on today, but we also look at poor detoxification, poor methylation, which is really a hot topic of discussion these days, poor digestion in general, and then the genetics or the single nucleotide polymorphisms or the epigenetic expression of the individual person as well. But for our conversation today, I think these four are really gonna help us dive down deeper into how we can work with digestive disorders. And then we are going to look at customizing the bio-individual nutrition strategy. And from there, we want to look at what are the food cravings that someone might have, what is their food consumption, you know, what foods do they eat frequently, what reactions do they have to foods that are already known, what are their common symptoms, and how do we compare that to symptoms that we commonly see being a problem with certain foods, what do their laboratory tests look like, their genetics, and other client considerations. So let's go into some of this and dive into it. That was just a bit of a high-level overview of the thinking that I use when I'm looking at how to apply special therapeutic diets for digestive health. So I want to dive into a little bit more on that pillar number two and pillar number five in terms of how to use those particular underlying factors to look at the underlying and contributing issues that go on for people with GI disorders and symptoms. So like I said, we're going to pick a few of those out. We're going to do inflammation, mitochondrial dysfunction, poor sulfation, and a microbiome imbalance. So, you know, poor digestion is an obvious one, so I didn't use that one. Let me go back a little bit. Methylation, to me, goes with sulfation. We'll talk a little bit about that. I don't want to get too heavy into genetics and SNPs here today, but those are valuable. And then poor detoxification as well. So those should not be overlooked. All of these can be a factor when we're looking at GI conditions. But I think that for the purpose of our conversation, I tried to pick some that I thought would be very universal for a variety of different health conditions, and some that you may not be as familiar with, like mitochondrial dysfunction or poor sulfation and some of the other areas where foods can be inflammatory and things that people might not be as familiar with. So when we look at inflammation affects the gut. Firstly, inflammation can be systemic or localized to the gut. And in the case of gastrointestinal issues, either or both of those are going to be problematic. And when there is inflammation in the gut, that's going to cause leaky gut, where the foods leak into the bloodstream. The immune system doesn't recognize them as nutrients, instead as invaders, and starts to send off all sorts of inflammatory cascade of problematic substances that the body then needs to address and deal with. And this also causes the body to identify those foods as food sensitivities, or, you know, because it's not perceiving them as a food, it's perceiving them as an invader. So, you know, inflammation really contributes to chronic disease in a variety of ways, in that it can affect every system. And so from there, it really plays a big role in disease, and a place that food really can have a profound effect in terms of choosing foods that reduce inflammation and adding foods, reducing foods that cause inflammation and adding foods that help to be anti-inflammatory. So in terms of the gut, this inflammation might look like diarrhea, constipation, gas, bloating, pain, but it can cascade there into pain, headaches, or joint pains, or other things as well. So in terms of dietary considerations, many of us are probably aware that we would want to avoid all food allergens. Somebody was allergic to peanuts, for example. That is going to significantly add very acute inflammation. but even more chronic types of inflammatory foods like food sensitivities, dairy, whether it's soy, you know, whatever that might be for that person. But beyond that, I think are some of the things that I think are particularly interesting and exciting. And those are things like oxalates and salicylates and amines and histamine and FODMAPs. We're going to talk about these later when I talk a little bit more about some of the diets. But just be aware, when I'm thinking about inflammation systemically or digestively, I am going to look at the role that these might play for certain individuals. Not everybody is going to get inflammation from all of these foods. We certainly don't want to remove these foods from everyone's diet, or else then we are going to end up with not enough foods left, a diet that's way too restrictive, a diet that then allows people to get food sensitivities to the foods they still have in the diet because there's not enough variety, and cause a whole host of other challenges. And so we only want to really remove the foods that are causing the problem. So that is the million-dollar question. How do we determine what foods a particular person is reacting to? And that's what we're going to talk about today. And then the last one there is grains. I think a lot of people beyond gluten and dairy-free and soy-free for gut issues are probably the second most familiar with grains being the cause of digestive issues, since we have a lot of really great books now on paleo and autoimmune paleo and the specific carbohydrate diet and the GAPS diet and all of that. All right, let me just check, make sure everybody's with us, see if there's any challenges. I think everybody's good so far. Okay, I shall keep going. And then the second thing is mitochondrial dysfunction. And this one probably may not be as familiar to many of you. I'm not speaking of mitochondrial disease, which is a very specific condition and only affects a very small number of people. I'm speaking of a dysfunction in the way the mitochondria are working. And mitochondria are those little powerhouses of the cell that make ATP. They make energy. And there are millions of those processes going on every second. And so if the mitochondria aren't working, that can negatively affect every single organ system, every single organ and every single body system, including the digestive system. So this is where mitochondrial dysfunction can be an issue. And there are some tests that people use to look at organic acid tests and other things to see if the mitochondria are functioning optimally or if there is some dysfunction going on. And so since they can affect every system of the body, they can often affect more than one system at a time. And actually, one of the ways that one of the doctors that I know in the world of autism helps to determine mitochondrial dysfunction is, are there three or more body systems being affected? If there are, then it's possible that there is mitochondrial dysfunction going on. And without good mitochondrial function, this can cause a variety of problems, as I said, throughout the whole body, but also digestively. And since that's what we're talking about today, I want to highlight that, leading to constipation, because you need energy in the intestinal tract to do those waves of what we call the migrating motor complex, which is basically just those peristalsis waves that move the food through the gut to the other end. And if we don't have enough energy being produced in the gut, then the muscle can't move along and move all of that, or the intestines can't move along and move all that food along with it. And so people tend to have more constipation. Once you have constipation, now you've got symptoms often of gas and bloating and toxins building up and pain. You could end up with just from mitochondrial, poor mitochondrial function itself, a lot of fatigue, even if it wasn't coming from the gut itself, but that's going to compound it. And then pain, both in the gut and mitochondrial dysfunction, can also lead to pain in other parts of the body as well. So this is where it's really important to consider what foods might be helpful or not helpful. And one of the interesting foods out there is oxalates, because oxalates can impair mitochondrial function. So if someone were eating a really high oxalate diet, and also on top of that, they weren't absorbing their minerals well because of that, that is going to compound their challenge typically. The other thing someone might look at is a ketogenic diet. Sometimes a ketogenic diet can be very effective for mitochondrial dysfunction. But it depends on the type of mitochondrial dysfunction they have. Because for some people, a ketogenic diet is actually the wrong diet for them. So for some people with mitochondrial dysfunction, it's very helpful to be on a ketogenic diet. For other people, it's very problematic, and they actually need to make sure they're getting adequate carbohydrates. And sometimes with the, with the focus on low carbohydrate diets lately, and sort of people kind of feeling like, oh, the lower the better, then what people end up with is a diet that's too low in carbohydrate. And if that's them, if they're having fatty acid oxidation issues and they can't burn the fat in the cell or in that mitochondria, then they're going to need those carbohydrates, or they're going to be even more deficient. So, you know, I think this is where, for me, dogma is really a frustrating thing, because, yeah, sure, I really think most of us should eat less carbohydrates. The average person eats way too much. But the challenge is that if we apply this one-size-fits-all kind of approach, and we say, oh, lower carb is good for everybody, everybody needs low carb even, now we can really get into trouble with some of the people that have mitochondrial dysfunction, because they can feel worse rather than feel better. So the third one they hear is poor sulfation. So sulfation is a biochemical process in the body where we add sulfate or sulfur to all sorts of different processes in the body that do everything from detoxify to help build the gut barrier to, gosh, all sorts of different really crucial systems for the immune system and detoxification and all sorts of things. So the blood-brain barrier, all of that. So we need good sulfation for this intestinal barrier to avoid leaky gut. The thing that avoids leaky gut, my mentor, who has since passed away but was just an absolutely lovely man, Michael Lang, he used to give, I think, a great analogy of, you know, when you're at the beach and there's one of those chain link fences, and there's, you know, those big holes in the chain link fence, and the wind blows the sand dune right from one side of the fence right to the other side of the fence. What the GAGs are, or the sulfated glucosaminoglycans, those are basically like putting little 2-inch boards through that chain link fence, and now you have a barrier so the sand doesn't get through. And that's the same sort of analogy of what sulfation does. That sulfate makes sure that the gut is not leaky. So if we have poor sulfation, which is very common in people with all sorts of neurological conditions, digestive disorders, mood disorders, then we are going to, and in fact, it's postulated that much of disease can be correlated, well, I should say this, for people that have poor sulfation, it can lead to a whole host of many different types of diseases. So sulfation is really important for good health. So it also requires good methylation, which is the biochemical step or two before sulfation. And we know, many of us who have been studying methylation know that methylation is crucial for proper genetic expression and for proper neurotransmitter production and all sorts of things from heart disease and cancer. All sorts of conditions require good methylation. And we know that a large part of the population has polymorphisms that in that methylation cascade. And so we have a lot of nutrients, a lot of enzymes that need to be functioning properly in order for sulfation to work. Dysbiosis can also compound poor sulfation. In fact, you know what I will do? I will include, when I send you an email with the slides, I will include a slide, because I don't think I included it here, from my book Nourishing Hope on the sulfation biochemistry and the methylation biochemistry, so you can see that, just to get a sense of how crucial it is for all of these nutrients and processes. In addition to poor sulfation being a huge factor in a leaky gut, and to, gosh, I should have said It kicks off all of digestion. It kicks off gastrin. It kicks off making sure that we've got the right pH in the stomach and all sorts of different types of things. In addition to all of that, dysbiosis or pathogens in the gut compound poor sulfation by depleting that sulfate because the bacteria and pathogens give their off their own phenols, which then suck up all the good sulfate that we need. So poor sulfation can result in lots of health problems, but also very specifically reactions to phenols, salicylates, amines, histamines, glutamates, as well as they also have a factor in oxalates as well, because if you've got low sulfate, now the oxalates can get into the cell and into the mitochondria on that sulfate transporter. So long story short, there are a lot of food components that can add inflammation to the gut, that if your sulfation processes aren't working well, then they can affect it. So people look at removing those foods that can deplete those systems and then work on getting that biochemistry going well with often some supplements and foods that can help get those pathways moving. But from a perspective of our conversation here today, with digestion, we want to look at if we're having inflammation in the gut, these phenols, salicylates, amines, histamines, glutamates, and oxalates can add significant not only levels of inflammation, but challenges very specifically with digestion. And then the fourth one is microbiome imbalance. And so we need that good bacteria for good digestion. And then conversely, pathogens are going to contribute to poor digestion and disease. And so eating a diet that supports good bacteria while starving out pathogens is important, but also a very tricky balance, because many of us know that we need good fiber. That good fiber is going to be fuel for the bacteria. That bacteria is going to create short-chain fatty acids. Those short-chain fatty acids are going to be fuels for the intestinal cells, and we need all that good stuff in order to function. And if we look at healthy tribes in Africa, we see them eating enormous amounts of fiber compared to what we do, and they are very healthy, and that's all wonderful. The challenge there is that even too much good bacteria can be a bad thing, and that's the case with SIBO, where you've got a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, often residing, an overgrowth in the small intestine, which can create a lot of pain from the fermentation of the certain fiber, leading to gas and bloating and pain. And so while we may need and generally want to get high fiber foods to support the bacteria in the rest of the colon, that can be tricky for those that have not only SIBO, but other types of digestive challenges. So it gets, again, it's a little bit trickier than just saying everybody needs fiber. But we also don't want to say everybody needs low FODMAPs, because in that case, we're now limiting something that is also very helpful. So, and then when you have a dysbiosis present, if you don't have enough good bacteria, if somebody's had maybe lots of antibiotics and wiped out some of the particularly important strains of bacteria, we might have issues with oxalates, because there are some good bacteria that break down oxalates. We also might have issues with salicylates and amines, as I mentioned in the last slide, because now we have the pathogens that are depleting the sulfate pool that we need to process salicylates and amines. And so when our microbiome is in imbalance, we want to consider, do we want to look at low FODMAPs? Do we want to look at low salicylates, low oxalates, low amines, or one that I didn't mention here but is probably obvious from above, which is higher fiber foods and probiotic-rich foods. Okay, so let's go into some of those diets now. I'm going to look at some of these. So these are the diets that I look at when I'm looking at digestive disorders. I want to look at food allergies and intolerances like wheat and dairy, eggs, nuts, soy, all those types of things. Then I want to look at opioids and the formation of opioids for some people, and diets that would be free of those opioid compounds, and those particularly are gluten, casein, and soy. The gluten grains, dairy products, and soy all have these very challenging to break down peptide or protein chains, and they also often have this weak bond in one position. I think it's a proline bond, I believe, that will is weak and it will break off and create this long, basically, chain, protein chain, that fits in the opiate receptor and functions like an opiate drug does. So we'll talk about that. Looking at various grain-free and starch-free options, the specific carbohydrate diet, the GAPS diet, the paleo diet, looking at low phenol and low salicylate diets, low oxalate diet, the low FODMAPs diet, anti-candida diets, low amine and low histamine diets, and low glutamate diets. So I'm gonna look at all those. And I put together a chart for you. In fact, this is a chart that I actually am creating a handout for all those people that are at NTA. That are at the conference. But for those of you that are on the line with me, when I get that created for the conference in a couple weeks, I'll go ahead and email it to you, because it's basically this chart that spans two pages on in a nice, easy to see kind of one page sheet, so you can put it in your office or with your notes that you're studying or whatever, and I think it might be helpful. So when I'm looking at foods food compounds and things that might create reactions, the first one we talked about are allergens like wheat or dairy, eggs, nuts, citrus, peanuts, chocolate, those types of things. This is a chart that I also use for the people that are in my training program. And actually, there's a few of you on the line from that as well. So I included the module that we talk about this. So if you want to, you know, go straight to that module and learn more about that, or, you know, compare against that, then I've included that bioindividual nutrition training module here for you. So in terms of food intolerances and allergens, in terms of what gut symptoms and what other effects these can have on the body, some of the really obvious ones are diarrhea, pain, bloating, constipation, very specific reactions in the gut, and this sense of gut inflammation and pain. But it can also, as we said, create systemic inflammation and pain, so people can end up with headaches and joint pain and a variety of other conditions as well. So therapeutic diets someone might consider are things like an elimination diet, where you eliminate those foods, elimination provocation trial, where we eliminate the top eight allergens and then add them back and determine which ones were the culprit, or rotation diets, where somebody might not need to eliminate all of the foods that show up, let's say, on a IgG panel, but they might want to rotate a variety of those foods. Other things, looking at those opioid-forming foods of the gluten, casein, and soy, opiates are like morphine. And what happens for people that have ever had surgery and they get pain meds and they get opiates, they are told that they're going to create constipation. And the reason for that is that opiates slow down motility in the gut. And when you slow down motility, you cause everything to go through slower. More and more water gets absorbed and the stool gets harder and more difficult to pass. And also that can cause a whole host of digestive issues, from toxins building up to pain to gas to bloating and inflammation and all of that. So that diet might look like an opioid-free diet. So a diet free of gluten, casein, soy. And actually the one I should add to this list is spinach. So if I were having a quiz, which I'm not having a quiz, all of you that are live on the call would also get an interesting little tidbit that spinach is very high in opioids, which I think is the reason why some people eat so much spinach, in addition to being told by a lot of what they hear in mainstream nutrition that it's so particularly healthy for you. But we're going to talk later about why it is really often, I'm not going to even say often, why it is really, I'm just going to go for why it is really not healthy for you. And then looking at grains and starches and removing those foods that are hard to digest, those foods that create a lot of inflammation, as well as feeding pathogens and SIBO. So what can happen, as Elaine Gottschall from the Specific Carbohydrate Diet, her book, Breaking the Vicious Cycle, she explains how when these starches and grains are not broken down by good digestion, which we know a lot of people don't have because they have inflammation, they're not able to get those enzymes from the release of the intestinal wall through the mucus and all of that inflammation into the where the food is to break those foods down. And so what happens is they become food for the pathogens and they start creating a lot of inflammation and damage to the gut. That then causes an opportunistic environment for those pathogens to grow even more, creating more irritation in gut and in the gut and more inability to break them down, and hence the quote vicious cycle. They also just generally are very inflammatory and difficult to digest and contain all sorts of little irritating compounds like oxalates and phytates and other things. So they can certainly cause diarrhea, constipation, pain, and all sorts of challenges. So those diets might look like or do look like the specific carbohydrate diet, the GAPS diet, the gut and psychology syndrome diet, and the paleo diet. And these are wonderful diets to remove those grains and those starches. And we don't necessarily have the capacity here to really talk too much about it, but if any of you have questions, one of the things that I like to share with students of mine in the course is, when do you use the specific carbohydrate versus the GAPS diet? Because in some ways they're so similar, but there are some very striking differences to them that might help you determine who might do better with one versus the other. And also comparing those to the paleo diet. So I'm happy to talk about that. I didn't really put it into my presentation, but if you're interested, I'm happy to. The next ones are things like phenols and salicylates, and I've brought those up a couple times. We're going to talk about some of those foods and things in a moment, but those are things like berries and grapes and bell peppers and honey and almonds and herbs and spices and apples and all sorts of fruits and also vegetables and all sorts of really high antioxidant-rich, wonderfully nutrient-dense foods. But when you don't have the proper sulfation to process them, they can cause very direct digestive symptoms like diarrhea. They can also increase pain from FODMAPs, which I thought was a really interesting study that they did. So that can compound FODMAP issues for those people that have an issue with them. And then they can create a whole host of other pain and problems in the body like headaches and migraines and other things. And those therapeutic diets look like low phenol diets, things like the Feingold diet or the fail-safe diet or kind of a variation of those diets that I like to share with people, as well as just a straight low salicylate diet. And then looking at things like oxalates. Oxalates are found in nuts like peanuts and almonds, all nuts, but some nuts are even higher than others. We'll talk about almonds in a little bit, but they have a large amount of oxalate in them. And spinach does as well. In fact, today I just heard on one of the oxalate boards how this woman for 10 years, she's in excruciating pain. And for the last 10 years, she has been eating, you know, all sorts of high oxalate foods, including 6 cups of spinach a day. And one serving of spinach is, and I'm trying to remember, 1 cup, I think, is it 1 cup of raw spinach? I forget. I don't want to misinterpret that. I think it's 3 ounces, and I forget exactly how much that is, but it's 500 milligrams of oxalate. So if you're having 6 cups a day, 500 milligrams is already 10 times the daily total for someone who needs to be on a low oxalate diet. So I would imagine her oxalate consumption is in the several thousands. So when that happens, that can create a lot of inflammation. Oxalates are very inflammatory. They cause oxidative stress. Like I said earlier, they can impair mitochondrial function. They can perpetuate yeast overgrowth. They actually, when you get oxalate, if for people that have had like oxalate poisoning from, like a poisonous plant or antifreeze or something like that. Seizures is one of the things that can result from like particularly high levels of oxalates. So oxalates are very, very, very damaging to the body and also inhibit mineral absorption on a simple level. So I am not a fan of super, super high oxalate foods, particularly on a daily basis. And for people where it's the gut has a big relationship with oxalates, or oxalates have a big relationship to gut and gut health, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And so I would look at something like the low oxalate diet in that case. Fermentable carbohydrates, onions, fructose, beans, I'll share a bigger food list in a second. These can feed SIBO and cause gas, bloating, pain, diarrhea, constipation, very, very specific gut-related conditions and symptoms. And the low FODMAPs diet is a really helpful choice. Some cases, they might need to even go and combine that with a grain-free and a starch-free diet as well, which isn't fully addressed on a low FODMAPs diet. Sugar is going to feed and perpetuate yeast and candida overgrowth, so looking at an anti-candida diet like a body ecology diet or something can be a great idea. Amines and histamines, these are other foods that I like to get the word out, are really wonderful, wonderfully nourishing, great foods. But when you have a reaction to these foods, they can create a lot of challenges. And so I like to let people know, be careful just from blindly suggesting large amounts of bone broths and sauerkrauts and ferments and things, particularly when someone is complaining about a lot of inflammation and pain, because amines and histamines, phenolic amines are in a similar compound to phenols and salicylates, whereas histamine is a type of amine, but it's not phenolic. So that's not so important for our conversation here. We'll just lump them together for now. But they can cause a lot of very specific intestinal and systemic inflammation. They can create direct diarrhea and abdominal cramps for people that cannot tolerate them. So a low amine or a low histamine diet can be very important. But again, on a broader level, they can create migraines and all sorts of other challenges. So that's something to look at. And then glutamate can also be processed in those similar pathways of the amines and the salicylates and things. And those are also found in things like sauerkrauts and bone broth, but also in foods like soy sauce. And don't be fooled by things like coconut aminos as well, and other types of things where people are trying to avoid soy. That substance that makes them taste really good, that's a very high glutamate, free glutamate substance. And so it is just naturally in the process of fermenting things. And so whether it's a soy sauce or a non-soy version, they're all going to be high in glutamate. Parmesan cheese is another one that's particularly fermented. And again, glutamate very directly can cause diarrhea, inflammation, systemic inflammation, gut inflammation, but also is very excitatory to the brain, to hyperactivity, to irritability, to aggression, as well as migraines. I heard a guy speak one year about how he gets seizures from glutamate and how sauerkraut would cause a seizure for him because it was so high in glutamate. So again, these are really wonderful foods. We just don't want to apply a one-size-fits-all attitude to them. So in this case, you know, someone might look at it like a low glutamate diet. All right, let's go a little bit into some of these diets in more detail, and then I will take questions. Let's see. All right, so I've got a few slides here, and then I'll get to questions. So looking at a gluten-free, casein-free, and other food sensitivities, you know, any kind of food sensitivities can create pain and inflammation, foggy thinking, anxiety, depression, hyperactivity, skin rashes, other digestive issues, and addictions to the foods. And in gluten and casein, we see really common reactions with IgG reactions. We see that a lot in all sorts of people. I know in autism, that's very common. But, you know, this gluten and casein are the some of the top allergens that the population has a IgG reaction to. Possible opiate response, inflammatory response, autoimmune responses, and other responses as well. Soy-free, soy is also very inflammatory and difficult to digest. It's broken down to the same enzyme that gluten and casein are. So I always look at soy-free when I'm looking at a gluten-free and casein-free diet. Looking at grain-free diets. So there's the specific carbohydrate and the GAPS diet, which remove all disaccharides and polysaccharides. So, they don't remove all polysaccharides per se, remove certain polysaccharides. And what they're going to do is they're going to remove all sugars, like things like table sugars, maple syrup, whatever that might be, any two sugar molecules, because what we're looking for is a nice, easy monosaccharide to digest easily. And then looking at starches and grains and those types of mucilaginous fibers like seaweeds and flax seeds and chia seeds and all those really slippery, sometimes wonderful for digestive components, but for other people who cannot break them down, they can be terrible for digestion. So that balance is really important. These diets do allow certain beans or certain legumes, whereas the paleo diet's a little bit different. It removes all the grains and also all beans rather than certain beans. It doesn't allow for added sugar either, but it doesn't necessarily look as much at disaccharides and polysaccharides. It doesn't remove those types of compounds. And they don't always remove all the starchy vegetables. In terms of, but I have to say that I do find that these diets, these grain-free diets, after a gluten-free and dairy-free diet, these diets can be a wonderful way to look at addressing gut issues. However, what I just want to let people know is to not apply a one-size-fits-all attitude to these grain-free diets. You might also need to look at, in addition to grain-free, low oxalate or something else. So keep that in mind because I think it's really important. I see too many people that come to me that are put on a straight, you know, grain-free diet as it's recommended, you know, by the author or whatever, or the practitioner, and they're eating tons of, you know, nut flours and, you know, whatever else. So just keeping that in mind. So maybe customizing the grain-free diet might be important. Or if somebody's issues, the bigger issue is not grains but oxalates, for example, maybe they do some grains, but they do low oxalate grains. So grain-free is not always the best diet for someone with digestive issues, although I do have to say that I do find very often it is a good place to consider. Low FODMAPs diet. So these are the acronym for fermentable carbohydrates, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. FODMAP foods are, here's some examples of some of those categories. So onions, artichokes, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, garlic, all that kind of stuff, and as well as legumes. And, you know, these are things that intuitively or through years of experience, we know that anybody, if they eat too many beans, will eventually overload that system and get some digestive discomfort. It's just some people, they are really intolerant to them because of their particular digestive situation, and they really can't handle any of them. Or very, very, very small amounts. Lactose for some people is an issue. Fructose for some people is an issue, particularly when fructose is higher than glucose. And then looking at sugar alcohols like xylitol and sorbitol and those sorts of things. And then looking at salicylates and phenols and some of these diets, there's artificial phenols, like artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, things like that. There are salicylates, as like aspirin is a derivative of salicylic acid, or it's a derivative from the white willow bark tree, and salicylic acid is the extracted compound that works with pain relief, and it is a type of salicylate. But we also have them that occur naturally in plants like apples and berries and turmeric and cumin and paprika and all of these types of things, as well as nuts and almonds and grapes and grape juice and wine and all that stuff. And then amines, so histamine and tyramine containing foods, those are going to be like fermented foods, are going to release those amines. So here's some of those foods. We've got the salicylate list I mentioned to you, then some of the amines, things like, if you think of certain things like chocolate, red wine, some of the things, cheese, some of the things you've heard that can create migraines. One of the reasons for that is these amines can create migraines for people that can't break them down. But also fermented foods, like we said, and some of the foods we talked about earlier. Glutamates, looking at you know, whether it's food additives like autolyzed yeast extract or, you know, MSG, or the naturally occurring ones, including Vegemite and Marmite and some of the other foods that I've already mentioned here. There are ways to make bone broths or broths in general lower glutamate and lower amine. But the standard way of making them is going to be quite high. Oh, here is that chart. I did include the chart for looking at the biochemistry of methylation here, this little blue box at the top, and then looking at this green transsulfuration down here. We need all of this and all of this working, which requires proper folate, B12, betaine, choline. We need zinc and magnesium and B6, and we have so many of these SNPs that are not functioning well and so many deficiencies that this is very commonly insufficient, and then we end up with insufficient levels of sulfate, and then we don't have enough of this enzyme that processes those phenols in the foods. So a phenol diet is for, a low phenol diet is what that should say at the top there. People with salicylate sensitivities, as I mentioned, can be more sensitive to the pain from FODMAPs. Pathogens give off phenols and deplete that chemistry we talked about. And so considering whether pathogens are present and making sure they're addressed is going to be an important component along with the dietary choices. So I do think that removing the foods is critical, but understanding enough of what's underlying it so that anything else that might be kind of a hole in the bucket, depleting that system, is like the pathogens, is also addressed. Oxalates. Oxalates are found in plant foods. They also can be made by the body. The gut is really important here because we need enough good bacteria. Do I have a slide on that? Yeah, we need, we need enough good bacteria. We need the gut not to be leaky so the oxalates can't get through. We need that good bacteria to break them down. We need to have good digestion so that we don't have fat left around that will bind to the calcium, allowing the oxalate into the body. Lots of areas that we need this to be working well. And that's going to directly affect the gut, including that oxalates inhibit biotin enzymes. And biotin is really important for controlling yeast. So there are a lot of ways that oxalates are going to interfere with good gut function, and poor gut function can cause issues with oxalates. So oxalates can affect the mitochondria, as we mentioned, dysregulating motility, increasing the chances of SIBO, and or adding to constipation. So oxalates are important when we are looking at the gut, and yet I rarely hear them ever talked about, and it's one of my favorite topics that I like to address in my training with people and when I'm speaking to doctors at conferences, because it's so important and such a little known area. So high oxalate foods are going to be nuts, particularly almonds. I mentioned I would tell you a little bit of the values here. So spinach, as I mentioned, has about 500 milligrams. A quarter cup of almond flour has almost the same amount, about 450 milligrams of oxalate. That means that, you know, people that are using nut flours in baking, they could be getting easily 1,000 milligrams of oxalate from almonds and 1,000 milligrams of oxalate from people that eat a lot of spinach or juice spinach. I mean, I have had clients with 2,000 milligrams of oxalate in their diet before, as well as beans and beets and Swiss chard and soy and chocolate and all sorts of other foods that are on this list. Oxalates inhibit minerals as well, so they're going to be an anti-nutrient even if you don't have particular oxalate issues. So I really like to mention that. I just feel like oxalates are not high, like extremely high oxalate foods are really a not a health food for anybody. In fact, I think that they're problematic for everybody. I mean, when we're talking about levels like some of the ones I just mentioned, I don't think necessarily a little bit of beets or a little bit of sweet potato or something like that, if you don't have an oxalate issue and you're eating small quantities of them on an infrequent basis, is necessarily an issue for everybody. But if you have an oxalate issue, those foods would definitely be off the menu completely. All right, so let's look a little bit. I wanted to share a little bit about the BioIndividual Nutrition Institute. For those of you who are joining us at the conference, you can come by the booth as well and hear a little bit. But I just wanted to share a little bit with you because we're going to be doing a very special NTA study group, particularly kind of like, I'd say really more of a coaching group for NTA students and graduates that are looking to take their specialized therapeutic diet strategies to the next level for helping to apply them bioindividually in their practice. And we've been doing this with NTA for 2 years now, and it's really a great group of people. We bring in the NAC, the nutritional assessment questionnaire, as well as the functional evaluation technique and all sorts of other interesting things that you use there over at NTA that can help people, you know, kind of bridge the gap between those two wonderful approaches to nutritional support. So I want to share that with some of you. It's not ready yet. It's going to launch in a few at the conference, but I thought I'd give you a sneak peek while you're all at it. Anyway, in the training, we talk about all sorts of these special diets that I have listed here and all sorts of these food chemicals and additives. So I've talked about a variety of them today. Some of my favorites being the low salicylates, phenols, oxalates, glutamates, histamines, amines, FODMAPs, you know, even things like lectins and sulfur and, you know, these types of things that we hear less about than we do some of the other compounds. And I have found them to be incredibly, incredibly valuable in my practice. And most people do not know anything about them. So a lot of people that will come to you will be suffering with something that you might very easily notice and be able to identify. So I was speaking at a school the other day in Brooklyn, and, you know, someone said, you know, why is nobody ever, you know, recognized? They were like, four, in my opinion, glaring cases of phenol issues. And it's just because most people don't know about them. And so most people would not, most practitioners, doctors, nutritionists, wouldn't know to even recognize the symptoms and things like that. So that's what I really like to tell people about is not only what foods are high in these compounds but and what foods are low, but when are they particularly helpful to remove? What are the common symptoms that are associated with them? What are the health conditions? What are the supplements that can help improve the processing of these so you don't have to restrict the diet forever? All that kind of information. So we go through that and all sorts of special diets along with methylation and mitochondrial support, lab testing supplements, and then how to put it all together into a system of strategies so that you can be methodical about figuring out what's causing a problem so that you only need to remove those things creating the issue. Remember that million-dollar question, what's creating the issue? How do I remove that without removing all the good nutrition? So it's 12 modules, 28 hours of course content, video presentations, PDFs of the slides, transcripts, video, downloadable audios, all sorts of things. And I think some people, one of people's like really favorite thing that they're looking for is that they really want things that are done for them that make things really easy for them to implement. So that's one of the things anytime people in the training program, say, oh, I'd love to see this chart, or I'd love to see a handout on this. I'm always adding more handouts. Some of these come from my very own practice because I had to create them myself. And so since I've already created them, why not share them all with you? For all the people that take the training, they've got all of the different diet implementation guides, the food lists, symptom charts, symptom and food and diet, charts, so that you can figure out what symptoms cause the most common, the common reactions with certain food compounds. Intake questionnaires, diet decision-making, strategy flow charts, all sorts of handouts, certainly GMO guides and toxin guides, but also things like high calcium, low oxalate foods, which people are always complaining about that they don't know what those foods are. So I made that really easy for clients and things like that. And then we've got an online assessment, so you can use that in your practice, have the client put their information in once. It spits out some really valuable information on which diets. Our professional community and our coaching calls, for which we have a special group just for NTA people as well, because you all have some really wonderful conversations in there about ways that you do things, which I think are really, really valuable. So people really like that connectivity. So the doors are going to open soon. We will send you an email when it does. We're going to have enrollment for this very special NTA peer coaching group, where we're going to do special coaching calls in the late spring. So if you're still studying, you've got several more months. Then we're going to be having these special coaching calls, and the doors open for this March 3rd, but the coaching calls, they'll start later so that you have some time. We've got a special discount just for NTA people, and we even have a 10-month payment plan, which will make the special discounted price available for all, only $277 a month. So we'll let you know when all that comes out. We'll email that to you. You will eventually find that on a special page just for you called bioindividualnutrition.com/NTA. And so that's going to be coming soon. Like I said, we'll get more out to you. But I wanted to tell you about it because some of you will be at the conference, some of you won't be at the conference, and I wanted you to know about it either way. All right, let's go ahead and Sheila, take questions from you. Okay. Is there a special test that you can do to see if you have leaky gut? It's a great question by Samantha. There are tests for leaky gut. There's a very specific leaky gut test where you drink different sugar molecules, and some of them are supposed to be too big to be able to get through the gut. And if they do get through the gut and you do find them in the urine, then you know the gut is leaky. But I find that practitioners often don't run that test. They often look at food sensitivities and other things, and if someone has over a certain amount of food sensitivities, sometimes they'll assume that someone has leaky gut, also based on symptoms and other things. So it really depends. There are tests that you can run, functional type tests that can help assess that, and sometimes people do that. Otherwise, sometimes people just make certain assumptions as well. Christian says, I love this information, but feel already overwhelmed that I won't know how to pinpoint these issues for my clients. I guess I need to take your course. I will be in your pre-conference class, so that will be a good start. Well, that's great, Christian. I know I'm trying to give you a lot of information in a short period of time, and I would say that if I have any flaw, it is speaking way too fast and giving way too much information in a short period of time. I just feel like I really don't personally enjoy being on a call where I have to spend the first 40 minutes going through boring background information I feel like I already know. And then I get like 10 minutes of quality content. So I apologize if I overwhelmed anybody. We will get a replay out to everybody so that you can listen to it again and again if you want. And if you're coming to the pre-conference workshop, even better. If you haven't already signed up for the pre-conference workshop, you can still do so. I think we already have like 50 people signed up. So definitely you still, if you go to register for the NTA conference, you'll see that this workshop is available right there on the registration page. So, you know, I would say if anybody else is feeling like Christian and wants to attend that pre-conference workshop, we will have all day to go over this. And like, you know, we also have the training program as well, which will get people quite a bit more information as well. So the pre-conference workshop is the first two modules from the training, plus a lot of the information we're talking about here, specifically on gut health. Since it's a gut health conference, I wanted to add that in, and we'll be taking that to the next level. So if you feel overwhelmed, please feel free to ask any of your questions now. And also know that there will be lots of other ways. We will be sending out a variety of different fun study guides, like handouts, case studies, educational pieces to help you drill this into your, into your memory and everything else that you might be doing. I mean, I have spent 15 years studying this, so, you know, I do kind of throw a lot of information out, and I tend to have a lot of people ranging from a lot of brand new students to people that have been doing this for 20 years. So I try to give a little bit of everything for everybody. You know, feel free to, you know, take what you can and then ask more. So one of Christian's burning questions, do you usually pinpoint these issues for clients symptomatically, or via testing, blood, stool, saliva, or both? Yes, both. So we will be talking more in the workshop that you're going to be coming to. But for everybody that's not, I have seven points. So on that, on my my pillars of the six pillars, step number five is creating that bio individual nutrition strategy. And that's where we answer this question for you, Christian, and I'll answer it for everybody that's not going to be joining us for that. And that is that I look at seven main things. I look at things, I showed that slide actually, now that I think about it. Let me take you to it, and I'll just show you the slide. Here we go. So these are the things I look at. I look at a combination of what their common symptoms are, what their other health considerations are, what their food cravings are, what foods they eat, what foods they love to eat, what foods they eat frequently, what foods we know that they react to, or other substances or chemicals we know they react to, what those common symptoms are, what laboratory tests that they've done. Some diets have laboratory testing that can be very helpful, some food compounds, to determine, and some do not. So for example, oxalates, there are some tests you can look at, whereas with phenols, it's really much more dietary based. We also look at the genetics and the SNPs and other things. So this is what I use to determine the diet direction for an individual person. And that's going to depend on both the type of practitioner you are and the access you have or the comfort you have with running lab tests, the state you live in and whether you're able to do that in your state, as well as, you know, I love to do as much as I can based on symptoms. So I have a very extensive symptom chart that you saw a few of the symptoms here. You know, looking at all sorts of behavioral and cognitive symptoms, physical symptoms, inflammatory symptoms, cellular problems, reactions to foods, mitochondrial challenges, all sorts of digestive issues in order to come up with that. So in my practice, I spent a lot of time looking at symptoms. And there are some symptoms that are very, very specific to particular food compounds. And so those are some of the little tricks that I like to teach people that are very specific. So things like red cheeks, red ears, and hyperactivity for kids with autism, very, very red flag for me for phenols, for example. If I saw those along with digestive symptoms, that's going to much better inform me on moving to phenols than just digestive symptoms, because digestive symptoms can be a factor in almost everything. So we're always looking at that and how that comes to play. Okay. Tara said, is there a way to determine if someone has a sensitivity such as oxalates, without ordering tests. So, yep, another person with that question. Yes, you can. To me, that chart I just showed you, what I would do is I would try to pull together as many of those pieces of the puzzle. So, yes, you can use symptoms. And, yes, for certain symptoms more than others, it's going to be much more of a glaring red flag for you. But there are some times that tests are very helpful, like with oxalates. However, again, like we have health coaches and other people that just don't run tests, and I think you can find a lot out by symptoms. So, you know, you can do that. You can determine that with if you're not a person that runs labs. You can get a lot of good data from the diet record and the common symptoms and their, you know, their cravings and things. Can you speak to the chart where it starts with folic acid? I had a client today that can't produce folic acid and was taking Deplin but was allergic to it because there's dairy in it. He's severely depressed and has lots of food sensitivities. Can you offer suggestions? Yeah. Okay, let's see. Okay. So the chart that I was referring to, or that Emily is referring to, where is it here, is this one. And this is obviously the folate cycle. I've since adjusted it, but I, you know, it confuses, it rightfully is a term I, you know, my book was written a while ago and the chart's from my book. For those people listening, folic acid is an inferior form of folate. We really want folate in a food form or in a methylfolate or a folinic form. And it does depend on the person. So it's not quite as simple as just, you know, you've got this one, you've got MTHFR, therefore you need methylfolate. Because their breakdown in this methylation cycle could be coming from a B12 issue or from a folate issue or from which enzyme in the folate pathway or, you know, a variety of other things. So, and there's other ways to kind of bypass that depending on if they've got a single or a double mutation, a homozygous or heterozygous. Just be aware that try not to simplify it down to making the determination based on a single SNP, because that is way oversimplifying it and can cause lots of people challenges. So, you know, it can look like things getting more folate in the diet. So instead of tons of spinach, I would maybe suggest lacinato kale, which is that like dino kale, those narrow dark green leaves. That's a really great way to get some good folate, depending again on whether they're able to do that or not. What is their issue? Do they have cerebral folate deficiency from antibodies to the folate receptor, and therefore they can't do dairy for that reason, and they really need large amounts in order to sort of almost flood the system to make sure that they can get enough through because of the folate receptor antibodies, or what might be at play. So let's see, I'm just trying to think. I would say, you know, what was the reason for the Deplin? Is there cerebral folate deficiency from folate receptor antibodies? And if that's the case, they might want to see if they can find another form of a high, you know, a higher dose like that. Or do they just need more usable form, like just a normal adequate amount of, you know, like 800 or 1,000 micrograms of methylfolate or folinic or something to that effect. That might, because then you could find that without the dairy, and you know, that might be a place to start. I think sometimes what happens is people, yeah, like too much of a good thing is also a problem. It's also, you know, is not a good thing. So, you know, looking at that and looking at maybe some of the other parts. So I'd say maybe looking at food-based forms, maybe looking at looking at just more normal amounts of it in a form that doesn't have dairy, all sorts of things like that might be a good way to proceed. Okay. Shannon says, thank you for your content, cramming it all in and getting right to it. I'm also one of those that gets frustrated spending valuable time for only 10 minutes of good content. This was great. Looking forward to finding out more regarding your program. Well, thanks, Shannon. I appreciate that. Tiffany says, are there guidelines for age-appropriate gut balances? How much do they vary? Are there guidelines for age-appropriate? I'm trying to think of, what do you mean by gut balances? How much do they vary? If you give me more feedback on that, I might be able to answer your question. What I would say is that there are differences for children versus adults versus elderly people, although generally the recommendations are similar, but with children things can be different because, you know, their bodies are smaller, and but their metabolic need is higher, and so it's almost more crucial that you get, it is more crucial in my opinion, that you get the diet right and that you don't overly restrict something that they might need. And Tiffany says, she added to that, do children have different microbiome needs? Well, they have different microbiomes to some extent, and they might, and I wouldn't say, though, that the diet to support the microbiome is radically different. I would say the things that support a good, healthy microbiome would be very similar to adults, although, you know, maybe the portions or percentages or something might differ, but otherwise probably fairly similar from that perspective. All right, great. Anybody else? I wanted to get us done before 3:30. Emily says, you mentioned that you could go into detail about how to tell if a client needs to do the GAPS diet or SCD. Can you explain? Yeah, I would say that a lot of that has to do with a couple things. And my personal opinion is the one thing, the main thing it has to do with is their personality. That's my sense. Now, there are differences. There are differences in the supplements that they do on the GAPS diet and some of the protocols like the detoxing protocol and things that are different on the GAPS diet. There are some differences in the way the foods are introduced on the two diets, so there are those differences. But one of the things I find the most profoundly different between the two is that the GAPS diet is much more specific of a protocol where you're doing a very specific, exact thing for a period of time. So in other words, some clients really love very rigid rules. They want to know, tell me exactly what to eat, exactly what to prepare, simplify it for me, and I'm going to do that. And GAPS is great at that. There are other people that would say, that overwhelms me, or I can't do 12 cups of broth and fermented foods every day because my amine issue is so significant that it would create a lot of, you know, more problematic discomfort. And so they might choose SCD because it can be more flexible, or there are people that have created protocols within SCD that are more flexible. But it doesn't mean that you can't apply either one of those diets to either groups of those people. But that's the primary thing that I often look at, is really like personality of the client, really. As well as there are some times where, trying to think, is there are some times where one protocol might be better than another, depending on what somebody needs in terms of, do they need higher amounts of certain supplements, or do they really need to go with the, what would I call it, the really restricted list of very, very small number of supplements that SCD has. Okay. All right, I'm going to take this one last question here for the sake of time. Michelle, thank you for your very thorough presentation. Would methylation be explained in your program so that the clinician would be able to look at the 23andMe results, raw data, and be able to use them in this context with their nutritional needs? We do talk about methylation. We do talk about 23andMe and the SNPs, and we do we do discuss that. We do explain it. We do help people put the bioindividual nutrition training information in that context to be helpful. But in addition to that, it is probably its own 28-hour course. I mean, you could spend months studying nothing but the SNPs and nothing but methylation. So yes, we do discuss it, and yes, we do help put some of those pieces together, and it will be helpful, I think, to for most people to help to explain methylation, to explain some of those SNPs, to explain some of the ways you might make certain determinations. But I want to also be realistic in that it is not an entire course in SNPs, because there are hundreds of them all interacting together. But I think, I've always had people say that it was very helpful, particularly because I've taken many of those other courses, and I think sometimes those courses are so detailed and complex that it's sort of missing the functional and practical component of what do you actually do with it. So this is much more on a practical, functional level. All right, everybody. Well, that is the end for today. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Julie Matthews, Certified Nutrition Consultant, and you have been joining us for the Bioindividual Nutrition presentation on choosing the right diet for supporting gut health. I hope to see you at the NTA conference, and I hope to see many of you at the workshop, as well as have some of you join us for our training program. If you have any questions, you can email me actually right away, anytime, at info@bioindividualnutrition.com. All right, everyone, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for all of your great questions. I hope you have a wonderful week. Take care. Bye.